Hello, I'm your host, Jason Merrill, and I'm very excited about the guest we have with us today on Mormon Expression Voices. Simon Southerton is a native Australian molecular biologist who is very well known in the Mormon blogosphere and Mormon academic studies, including his interactions with Mormon apologetics. He is the author of the popular book, Losing a Lost Tribe, Native Americans, DNA, and the Mormon Church, a book that questions the veracity of the Book of Mormon and its claims that Native Americans are of Hebrew descent. Welcome, Simon.
Thank you, Jason. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, good to have you, and thanks for agreeing to do the interview. I've been excited to talk to you, and I'm interested in all your research you've done, so I'm excited to hear your story today.
That's good.
Okay, so let's start out and have you tell us about how you came to be a member of the church and what your experience was like growing up.
Well, it was a long time ago. The church first contacted our family when we were living in a small town in western New South Wales, and I was only very young then, and our family were taught the church for a little while, and we moved, and I think they lost contact with missionaries. But it was eventually when I was about the age of 10, the missionaries taught our family in Sydney. We were Anglicans at the time, and reasonably devout Anglicans, but I think probably the main thing that made our parents feel a bit uncomfortable in the Anglican church was that we had a very large family, and my father was very keen for all of the family to attend the typical mass, the Anglican mass that they have on Sundays, whereas most parents just let their kids skip it. And so, yeah, we were fairly, you know, big families are noisy. And so they just felt a bit uncomfortable. So when the missionaries came, they listened to them. It took 9 months. Taught for 9 months. Back in the day, those days, that's how long it often took.
Oh, wow.
And then we were baptized. Most of us were baptized. My older sisters didn't at the time. They were sort of in their late teens, and some of them were out of the home. But eventually they joined, so within about 4 years, 3 or 4 years of missionaries teaching us, we'd all joined the church.
Okay. So do you remember feeling a strong attachment to what was being taught and the lessons, and were you more or less going along with your family? Or?
Oh, look, I was only 10, so I was definitely going along with the family, but I was very, very happy and comfortable with the whole thing. I idolized the missionaries. They were a great bunch of it was probably about 3 or 4 sets of missionaries that eventually taught us over the 9 month period. But it was, yeah, really enjoyed the missionaries. And we were socialized into the church very well over, you know, a long period. So we had lots of good friends by the time we joined. The church was booming in Sydney at the time, like double digit growth, regular families joining the church. Which is now very uncommon. It's not typically a single people now, but so it was a positive experience. I didn't enjoy the Anglican church at all. It was a bit cold, and I just made some really good friends in the church. Yeah, so it was a real positive, I think, for our family, looking back.
Yeah.
At the time, yeah, it would have been – I was still pretty young, so I didn't really feel like I had my own sort of testimony until I was probably in my mid-teens.
Okay.
I wasn't like your regular missionary that often develops their testimony when they're in the mission field.
Yeah.
When I went on my mission, I felt like I really knew the church was true. And so generally a pretty positive experience, I think.
Yeah. Okay. So you had some of the usual attachment to the teachings of the church about family and the whole story of Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon.
I think our family, you know, we had 9 kids. That's extremely unusual outside of the Mormon church. And so we came into the Mormon church, there were quite a few other families that had 9 kids. So we just really fit in really well. We formed, you know, really close friendships with you know, some really, really wonderful families. And those friendships are still there today, particularly from my mother, who goes, you know, goes to the temple now with many of the, with some of those people that she, we first met in the very first war that we're in. But it was a time of, you know, this is the 70s in Australia, which was I think it was probably the same around the world. It was a time when the, you know, the church was really booming and I think a pretty happy place to be. So pretty positive experiences. But I, in terms of the Book of Mormon, I certainly remember the lessons that we were taught in the film strips about, the ruins in South America and the baptismal fonts here and the 12 temples here and the things that the similarities that were drawn out between the archaeological record and the ruins there and what's in the Book of Mormon. So I just felt it just, to me as a 10-year-old, it all made perfect sense. Yeah.
And did you have an interest in science at a young age?
I think I had an interest in, certainly in growing plants at a very young age. I was gardening with my dad and growing vegetables pretty much all my, well, as a toddler and then into my teens. So I think I always wanted to study agriculture. And so I just managed to scrape into agriculture at Sydney University and thoroughly enjoyed that. So, it would be fair to say, I don't think I recognised that I had a real interest in science. I just had an interest in biology, I think. Mm-hmm. And that sort of blossomed into eventually moving into a career in science.
Okay.
Yeah, so when I was at university, it's interesting, when I reflect back, I didn't really fully accept evolution the way most scientists now accept evolution until I was well into my first postdoc. So I'd done a degree and a PhD in agricultural science, and I really hadn't fully accepted evolution. So you can still get a nice honours degree and a PhD and not accept it, which is really quite bizarre. It was only when I was in England and a very good friend of mine over there, who was a member of the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or the Community of Christ now, he sort of challenged me on it. And it was the first time I'd really been challenged on it. And so, in the discussions and with him and just pondering about it and thinking about it, that's when I fully accepted that, evolution did occur the way I'd learnt in university. And it's just interesting how you can learn about stuff and it can make an awful lot of sense to you, but you just don't accept it until some, significant event in your life.
Yeah, that's similar happened. Yeah, similar thing with me. I started to study a lot about the Big Bang and the origin of the universe and how life formed on Earth, and I think that's when I first started to question the existence of God, I think, for me. And yet I still hadn't really lost my faith in the church, which doesn't make a lot of sense at the time, but I kind of lost a lot of my belief in God first before I even questioned the restoration, so...
Okay, that is interesting.
Yeah. And I don't know how I did it now.
Cognitive dissonance.
Yeah, really, strong cognitive dissonance. But
double think, I like to.
Yeah. Because I think the story of Adam and Eve kind of fell apart pretty quickly when I studied evolution. So I wonder if that was similar for you. If you, up until that point in your undergraduate studies, you were thinking, just accepting the church's story about the young earth and Adam and Eve.
I don't know what it is. Maybe I just wasn't a deep thinker about these sorts of things, but I had a complete faith in the church, and I didn't dwell on those sorts of things. Yeah. I was fully engrossed in you know, the church and doing stuff, you know, the youth program, the young adult program, all sort of stuff, going on missions. I don't remember sort of firmly believing that there was the earth was 6,000 years old. Mm-hmm. And I think I always sort of believed, I just hadn't bothered to try and reconcile the whole thing. And I think it was only through maturing and, you know, being exposed to a lot of the science, that it just became gradually just so apparent that the earth is very, very old. It's billions of years old. Plants and animals must have evolved in the way that science, but, you know, the science just revealed, particularly on the molecular side, it's revealed very, very clearly the whole process of evolution. It's all written into the DNA, and you know, very, very closely related organisms have very similar DNA, and very distantly related organisms have very, very different DNA, but they all share DNA. And, mm-hmm. And it's completely consistent with the you know, the family tree of living things that scientists had built up without the benefit of DNA, just looking at the morphological similarities between living things. So gradually, really without me sort of really recognizing it consciously, I reached a point where, yes, I, you know, the world, I mean, it's billions of years old. There was no Adam and Eve put on the earth 1,000 years ago. There was no global flood. That's just not possible. It's not possible if you're not prepared to believe that God is a con man and prepared to remove evidence and trick his children. So, you know, if you want to believe in a 4,500-year-old flood, you have to believe that God is deliberately hiding evidence in order to test people. Well, what's the point of that? You know, what sort of a God is involved in that sort of plan? It just makes no sense. So yes, there was, and really, it's the. I think it's. Yeah, it's when the thing that really, I think the trigger for me was, as I've written online in my exit story, is the trigger for me was when I was a bishop and I was reading an article in The Ensign, by, you know, a BYU history professor that essentially told me that I was a less than faithful member because I didn't believe that there was a flood, a global flood 4,500 years ago. And I was misinterpreting the evidence. And, you know, I just didn't believe at the time that the Mormon Church were a bunch of creationists. Mm-hmm. I knew there were many other people that didn't share a belief in a, you know, a 6,000-year-old earth and a global flood within the church. Yeah. But there wasn't really an open dialogue going on.
Yeah.
I know back in those days, this is about 1998, it was, yeah, I don't think there was an awful lot of open discussion about this sort of thing. It was sort of hushed up. Mm-hmm. You're not questioned.
Yeah, you know, when I was in the church, I've always had a deep interest in science myself, and I remember sitting in church, and there was a lesson in gospel doctrine about the flood, and of course they talk about the moral aspects of the flood and the lesson that it teaches us, and I'm thinking about the what actually happened and the fact that, you know, the earth was covered with water completely for, you know, in some accounts a month, in some accounts a year, but anyway, a long period of time, and I couldn't figure out how plants could survive with, you know, being underwater for that long, or how you could feed an African lion, you know, that requires, what is it, 60 pounds of meat every 3 days or something like that.
Yeah.
I just couldn't figure it out, and I didn't know why this was just kind of brushed over in church.
I've got a good friend who's used to work at CSIRO, and he's a creationist, and he's been he's quite internationally quite well known in the creationist circles. And I had a few discussions with him, and you know, the logic and the reasoning is just, it's just so bizarre. You know, how do you explain the fact that all the marsupials got to Australia from the flood? Mm-hmm. Why didn't the lions chase them down? Were they just faster? Did they hop faster? But, you know, we've just got a country that's filled with marsupial mammals. And did they just accidentally find their way here? It's just, they're just really poor answers. And we don't have to have poor answers. I was never in the church to avoid the facts or to avoid the truth. And so when I read that article on the flood in the Ensign, I think being in the Ensign really bugged me. You know, this has gone to everyone, and all the adults in the church are reading this nonsense. And, so I only want to believe in things if they can be true. And if the facts clearly tell you that something isn't true, then I'm not going to bury my head in the sand and not face it. And so that's sort of reading that article and that being so upset about that, I went on to what was a very young internet back in 98. It was just really taking off. Pretty ordinary search engines and that sort of thing. Found no articles on the flood, but that's when I stumbled on the first DNA research on Native Americans. Hmm. I don't know how that came up in one of the searches, but I must have been thinking about, you know, what other issues are there out there, and that's when I stumbled on the Smithsonian article. That also shocked me quite a lot, I think. Mm-hmm. That was not sure of how many people would be aware of it, but it's a. I even remember when I was a seminary student being told that the Book of Mormon was used by the Smithsonian to help them with their research on Native Americans. And then to read a statement by the Smithsonian utterly refuting this, not just sort of saying, no, it's got nothing to do with it, but, you know, systematically going through and pointing out the complete disconnect between the Book of Mormon and reality, that really surprised me, because it was a very forthright and clear rebuttal of many things in the Book of Mormon by scientists. And scientists don't normally do that when the evidence can sort of go either way.
For our listeners, is this this study by the Smithsonian, or this article that was published, does it talk about the DNA aspects or the archaeological issues with the Book of Mormon?
Yeah, and this was prior to DNA sort of entering the scene.
Okay.
Because they used to get lots of letters from Mormons, the Smithsonian, asking about how, you know, what things they'd found that supported the Book of Mormon. And eventually they wrote this form letter, and they would send it back to everyone that wrote to the Smithsonian. But not long after I came across that, the apologists got in touch with, put a lot of pressure on the Smithsonian via Mormon senators, politicians, put a lot of pressure on the Smithsonian, so they stopped sending it, and they watered down the letter to some to some other response because of the pressure from Mormon politicians. It was prior to the DNA, which raises, I think, a very significant point. The DNA research has not really significantly modified our understanding, or the scientific understanding, of the origins of Native Americans. Scientists have known for decades, probably for about most of the last century, scientists have virtually unanimously agreed that Native Americans came from Asia and they entered via the Bering Strait during the last ice age, when there was a land bridge between the two continents. Mm-hmm. So DNA, don't for one moment think that DNA suddenly reveal this all to the scientists. It's clarifying the picture. It's giving us a better idea about the date of arrival, the precise location in Asia where their closest descendants are, the route that they came into the Americas, and the timing of their spread throughout the Americas. That's where DNA is really giving some very useful and interesting tidbits.
Yeah.
But it's just sort of refining a picture. It's the scientific consensus has been solid for a long, long time. Now, I can understand many people feeling, well, that's ridiculous. We hear all of this stuff on the Discovery Channel about, you know, Greeks and Hebrews and you name it, Chinese, and these migrations to the America, you know, for thousands of years. But that's fringe science. That's popular science. It's not real science. You know, these magazines, people who print magazines have got to sell them. So they, if you tell the truth and the same old story that isn't as exciting, people don't buy the magazines or they don't buy the DVD. And so that's why you end up with, you know, this, you know, popular perception that they're, you know, they were migrating in from all over the place.
Great. That's fascinating. I would like to go back a little bit first and have you bring us from the time where you served your mission and have bring this up to the time you were serving as bishop and kind of what those experiences were like for you as a member of the church. Was your mission a good experience for you?
I think by and large, yeah. I served in Melbourne. Mm-hmm. Australian missions are reasonably challenging. You don't baptize lots and lots of people. Most people only baptize a handful of people during their mission. I grew to enjoy door knocking. It was a door knocking mission. My mission president, on the very first meeting with us, brand new missionaries, he told us that Melbourne was a door knocking, tracting, house to house mission.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did for 2 years. Now I think you can go on a mission and sit in front of a computer the whole time. Right. It's ridiculous. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Had lots of good experiences.
Yeah.
that's where I went knowing, really believing that I knew the church was true, but I hadn't had a witness in answer to prayer like a lot of people claim. Mm-hmm. I went through a phase early in my mission where I tried to obtain that witness, and I didn't. It was very frustrating at the time, but my mission president assured me that that's a common experience, and don't be bothered. You felt the Spirit, so it's all good. So. Hmm.
Was this trying to pray about it and fast, or what were you doing to try to get that?
I was praying and fasting every day, every night, morning and night, for probably a month or so. And which is, you know, pretty bizarre. You know, I already believed it. I wanted it to be true.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I believed it was true. I didn't feel like it was an unrighteous request. Lots of other missionaries were claiming they felt the Spirit and stuff like that. Yeah, that was something that did bother me. I'm quite an emotional sort of a fella. I'm pretty unusual. Personality for a scientist. Scientists tend to be a little bit more logical. I'm not. I'm more of a feeling type person. And I felt lots of emotions. Felt strong emotions when I listened to the prophet speak, Tim Spencer Kimball. So that was sort of one thing that I wrestled with for a little while on my mission. But overall, it was a great experience. And then, yeah, came home, married very quickly, and still married to Jane, my wife, very happily. And Jane, so we met not long.
Hello, I lose you. You're breaking up a little bit.
Okay.
I heard you say noise. I can edit this part out, but I heard you say you married quickly and met your wife, Jane.
Well, we I think we were dating within about 2 months of my return from a mission. I think we were married within about 6 months later, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. So we...
That's pretty standard for Mormon timelines go.
Pretty standard. Oh, look, you know, we had, you know, our engagement was announced in a stake meeting.
Wow.
Look, there was a lot of pressure on kids to get, when they got back from the missions, it was right in your face.
Yeah.
You're getting married. How times have changed.
Yeah.
Now, it's very common now for people to be in their late 20s or even 30s before they marry. That was just not the done thing back then. So, we were always very active in the church. I think I served as a young men's president in 5 different branches or wards, in the young men's presidency or the president or a bishopric counselor, branch counselor, or, and then finally as a bishop. So we have 5 children, fairly standard Mormon size family.
And good experiences in the church this time? Any spiritual experiences you were having? Or?
I think good experiences, but I must admit that I did start to become when I was first married, I was fairly anxious that my wife's parents came back into activity because they'd been inactive for a long time. Even when my wife joined the church, she joined the church when she was about 16 or 17, and they were inactive at the time. They never came back to activity, so I felt anxious about getting them into the church and getting into the temple, that sort of thing. But I think I must admit I did find the church a bit tiring. You know, one of the wards that I was in, particularly with home teaching, something used to bug me. I wasn't entirely comfortable with this, you know. Why do we have to get in the homes of these people every 4 weeks? This is just a bit invasive. Why are we doing it? And I realised sort of, you know, by the time I'd become a bishop, I realised this is just about stopping people going inactive. This is about stopping people leave the church. And I knew by then that, you know, visiting teaching was also, it was just wholly about getting into the house, seeing if there's any, if they're doing their scripture reading and their family prayer and making sure they're not leaving the church. Well, why all this enormous effort? If this church is true, why do we have to go to such enormous effort to stop people leaving? It should be a wonderful, fun place. And really the church, that's the biggest change that I noticed, I think. It just wasn't the happy, vibrant place that it used to be. And you know, we had this was quite a common feeling, I think, in Australia. I remember distinctly I was in the High Council briefly in Canberra probably 20 years ago, just before we left Canberra. And they had a testimony meeting. We all bore our testimonies, and almost every one of these guys got up and said, look, I only go to church because I know it's true. And they were the unhappiest bunch of blokes. And I came out of that meeting so disillusioned. If this is God's church, why are these people miserable? And why do we have to go when we're miserable to go just because you believe it's true? And I don't think that's uncommon these days. I think there are a lot of wards where, I'm not saying that there aren't wards where they're wonderful and they're booming and they're really happy, but Canberra at the time was really struggling. And that's when we moved to Brisbane, and I eventually became the bishop. And I guess the rest is history in some respects.
So you're a bishop now and your life is consumed by the church. And how are you feeling at this point? Are you having questions in your mind? Are you just very dedicated at this point as a new bishop?
No, I have no serious questions about the truthfulness of the church. Mm-hmm. Still had a very firm testimony. But I I think the biggest feel, the sense, one of the things that was starting to bother me was, you know, that in the church I felt that a lot of things were just sort of out of, my life was almost out of my control. You know, the stake president calls me and he calls me to be the bishop. And I, you know, that's a life-changing event. And it, I, you know, I wasn't terribly keen to be the bishop. I did enjoy many aspects of being the bishop and serving in the ward. It had a deaf unit, which I got really involved in, which is a fairly uncommon thing in the church back then. And that was a wonderful experience, very challenging. I did start to get uncomfortable with things. They weren't a testimony, challenging things, but little things. Like, I remember being, we had a bishop's training meeting and all the bishops were brought down and we had the stake president stood up and said, look, we've had a direction from the area presidency that because sacrament meeting is a priesthood meeting, women are no longer to give the closing prayer. Hmm. Well, so I thought to myself, that's interesting. Hmm. And normally I would just sort of let that thing ride, but then I thought, hang on.
Sure.
I'm not sure about this. Why? So I asked, why? And he said, I don't know. We were just told that. Hmm. And it's interesting because I talked to the previous bishop about this not long afterwards. It might have been a few, I think it wasn't all that long afterwards. And he laughed his head off. He said, oh, we had the same reading, same sort of instruction about 3 or 4 years ago, but they couldn't give them opening prayer. And then other things like the prophet telling us that girls can have one earring, but they can't have two, and boys can't have any earrings. Mm-hmm. And I'm sort of thinking to myself, what is that's the only revelation I really heard from the prophet that's new. Is that the sort of stuff that God's really worried about? Is it that important that that's the only revelation we get?
Mm-hmm.
It's little things like that start to, we're starting to bug. Another one was when we were in Brisbane and there was no temple in Brisbane. We had to do temple trips to Sydney, which was a 14-hour trip in the bus. And they typically went to the temple, went to the beach afterwards and then came back. Sydney's got great beaches. And we got this calls to tell us, and so it was a great experience because the young guys and the guys and the girls would go down there and they'd put on these, they'd all be wearing these big jumpsuits and they're all together. But then we got this instruction that they had decided that it was inappropriate for the boys to be sitting there while the girls were being baptized. Thanks. Because when they came up out of the water, the jumpsuit they were wearing would cling to their bodies, and you could actually see their figure. You couldn't see anything else. You could make out that they were female from this really thick jumpsuit that they're wearing. And so, the consequence of separating the boys and the girls meant that there was the time at the temple took a lot longer. The boys and the girls weren't together in the temple. It was less of a sort of a team experience. Yeah. And so I rang him up. I rang up somebody who in the temple and asked why. And I got this same response. I don't know. That's what we were told and we've just done it. Yeah. And so I guess, and I think you see this today now with the this increasing pressure on the members to not question anything. As soon as the brethren have decided something, end of discussion. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing this right now at the highest levels. And, you know, in some ways they've let the genie out of the bottle with all these essays that are revealing lots of problems. And so people are starting to question, but then they're, now I think they might even be regretting their decision because they're putting a lot of pressure on members to just follow the prophet, don't question anything that they say, and you'll be safe.
Sure.
You wonder, what's the point of God putting us on this earth if it's just to learn to be blindly obedient to instructions from the prophet? It just doesn't seem to fit with the whole, you know, purpose of this, what I thought was the purpose of life.
Right.
So those little things were definitely niggling, but that wasn't common. It wasn't like I went along to every meeting and every church service and was dwelling on these things. By and large, it was positive, and we did all the things that we, you know, I did all the things that normal bishops were doing. Our families participated in the church just like everyone else. But those little things were in the background. They came to the foreground when I first started to seriously question the Book of Mormon.
So bring us to that point. Where were those first cracks appearing in your life at that point?
Well, the first crack was definitely that when I the first crack was the flood. That article in the Ensign, which really annoyed me. It would be fair to say that I was upset by that. I was angry. Mm. This guy didn't even have a science degree, the guy that wrote it. Mm-hmm. He's a Hebrew professor at Brigham Young University. He's writing an article on the flood and talking about all sorts of scientific evidence, and he doesn't know what he's talking about. So that's when I basically put my foot down. No, the flood did not occur, and if that's what the church expects me to believe, I'm not going to believe it. And that, I think that marked a point where I think from then on, I wasn't going to accept blindly what the church expected me to believe in relation to scientific things. Mm-hmm. And then that sort of led to a much deeper, a much closer look at the Book of Mormon and the archaeological evidence. And there's nothing. There is absolutely no archaeological evidence in support of the Book of Mormon. Mm-hmm. Nothing. It's a vacuum. There's abundant evidence all over the United States that Native Americans arrived well before 13,000 years ago. That's a scientific fact. That's the truth. We have to face the truth. I wasn't prepared to believe things that I knew were not true anymore, and that's sad. Is a real problem for the church now. Wanted to believe the historicity of the Book of Mormon, and in my view, that sets the church up against scientific facts. Mm. You can't, if you expect people to believe things that are not true, when there's abundant evidence that they're not true, you're really you're in danger territory. It's just really unfortunate for the church that they've dug their heels in on this one. I don't know how long it's going to last. The Community of Christ gave up on the historicity of the Book of Mormon a long time ago. Mm-hmm. I don't know what impact that had on their total numbers. They probably declined a bit, but I think that one day the church has to face facts and allow members to not believe in the historicity of the Book of Mormon. Mm-hmm. Sure, it might challenge many other beliefs in the church, but there are plenty of people that still go to the Community of Christ, and they're over it. Right. They've got past that issue.
So. Okay, so you're a bishop, and you're having these issues in your mind about the conflicts between science and Mormonism, and are you having to talk about these to your congregation as far as when you bear your testimony? Or are you kind of avoiding some of those aspects of testifying to the Book of Mormon and its truthfulness, or what was going through your mind?
It is interesting. It's very difficult to talk about. Certainly, didn't talk about these things publicly in a meeting or anything like that. But I did talk to another Mormon scientist, and his argument was that Native Americans looked like Asians because they migrated from the Americas into Asia. That's how he rationalized the relatedness. So they came from the Middle East and then migrated into Asia. Complete nonsense. But we had a discussion. He spoke to his wife. He mentioned it to his wife. And his wife spoke to the Relief Society president, and the Relief Society president spoke to the state president. And within a week, the state president, who was a good, really lovely guy, visited my ward and sort of very politely asked me not to talk about those sorts of difficult issues with anyone anymore. Right, so I couldn't even talk about a scientific quandary with a scientist in my ward. Who else can I talk to? Not many people. So it was only my wife that I was able to talk to. I also spoke to my brother, but very few other people. So, yeah, so that was difficult. So I went for about 2 weeks where it was largely dwelling on these things myself. And then one night we, as we often did, our kids are pretty young, sort of between the ages of about 2 or 3 and up to about 14, 12, 13. We sang, for some reason, Book of Mormon stories with our children one night before we put them to bed. So we put them to bed, and then I went to bed, and I was just so deeply troubled. I just knew we were never going to sing that song again. That song is just absolute nonsense. So I was deeply troubled and went to bed, and during the night my subconscious must have sorted a whole lot of things out, because I woke up in the morning and I knew the Book of Mormon wasn't true.
Wow.
So for about 2 weeks I lived and breathed doublethink. I had two very conflicting views in my mind. They weren't sorting each other out. So I absolutely knew the Book of Mormon was true. But Native Americans had Hebrew ancestors, but I also knew that Native Americans had all their ancestors were Asian. So, and I woke up in the morning and that's when I resolved it. I just, it was an amazing experience. It was an epiphany, a really clear epiphany. I don't know I've often wondered about what physically is occurring in your mind and your brain when that sort of thing happens. And, I don't know, it's a fascinating experience to go through, but from that day onward, I've had really no doubt at all. And now I'm absolutely certain the Book of Mormon is not historical. That can be quite an issue if you're a bishop to be in that situation. So I really didn't hesitate at all. I was in touch with my state president and meeting with my state president within a couple of days.
Yeah.
I asked to be released. He pleaded with me to stick around for another 4 or 5 or 6 weeks until we get another bishop. And I told him, no, that's just not going to be possible. So,
yeah, were you asking him because you had lost your faith in the Book of Mormon, or because you had lost complete faith in the Mormon Church itself?
Oh, the complete faith in the Mormon Church. Mm. Absolutely. If the Book of Mormon is not true, then the whole church has something. Yeah, there are big problems.
Mm. Yeah.
So, I obediently followed the instructions of President Kimball. who was the prophet when I was a teenager, and I faithfully read the Book of Mormon, and my testimony was built on the scriptures, and it rocked the foundations, and so I knew I had to be released. So I was released, and then for about 5 weeks, we had a member of the state presidency acting as the bishop, and I helped him out with stuff. It was all of the interactions with stake leaders, local leaders, were really polite and very positive. So, I never had any issues at all with them. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but I think it was, it would have been, I think, it wasn't the following Sunday, but it was that I was released, it was about a week and a half after I met with the state presidency, I was formally released in a meeting.
Okay. And how did that go over with your ward members? Did you have...
Some struggled a little. I even spoke at the meeting where I was released, and I specifically asked the members, or told the members, that they didn't need to know my reasons for being released, but it was the right thing to happen. Mm-hmm. So I think that effectively stifled most of the inquiries. I didn't get a lot of people sort of asking. It was just the odd one or two people that really wanted to know. I told a very good friend of mine who was a member of the bishopric in another ward that was meeting in the same building, because he was just a close friend, and we golfed together. And so I told him. And
hey, Jason jumping in here. At this point in the interview with Simon, I lost connection with him, so he was unable to finish his thought. But it was really only a few seconds. So here we continue on with the interview with Simon Southerton. So I know, Simon, you talk a lot about in your blog about the interactions you had with the church leaders after you were released as bishop. Can you bring us up to that and tell us a little about that story about your interactions with the stake president and your area president?
Okay. It was probably about a month or 6 weeks after I had been released. I'd only been talking to the stake president and only a couple of times. And I got a letter. I suddenly received a letter from the area president, who I'd never met, never spoken to. And it was a pretty terrible... You there?
Oh, no, I hear you.
Sorry.
You were talking about the letter?
Yeah, I received a letter from Elder Featherston, who was the area president. And it was a pretty terrible letter. It was one of those letters that was designed to fill me with fear. I was destroying the family and breaking my mother's heart, and I'd be a hollow shell of a man if I left the church. Mm-hmm. And a few scriptures, appropriate scriptures. The whole thing was designed to fill me with fear, and it was pretty terrible. And what was more disappointing was that this letter was written on the basis of hearsay. He hadn't spoken to my stake president. Mm. He'd heard a rumour that there was a bad bishop in Brisbane. So he's evil. He's leaving the church, so he must be evil, and I'm going to write a scary letter and scare him back into the church. So I wrote back to him. I took him to task on that one. I told him how inappropriate it was. That I was talking to the state president, and he'd been very kind and supportive. He'd assumed that I had decided I was just going to leave the church. Well, I hadn't actually made that decision. It was a very difficult time. I didn't believe the church was true, but I hadn't necessarily decided to withdraw the family from the church. And so we were still attending at the time.
Yeah.
It was just absolutely unhelpful, not the way that you should. And the state president saw the letter, and quite a few other people have seen it, and they're quite troubled by it.
Yeah, you know, there's one section there I wanted to read and get your reaction to this paragraph, because this is what stood out to me in the letter that you posted on your blog. He said in the letter, "True science will always vindicate the truth of the gospel. We are not only concerned about you, but about your family and others who have great confidence in you. If you set aside the gospel for what you now suppose is truth, you will be throwing away the great pearl of great price for a mess of pottage. There will be nothing to replace the great faith, the marvelous principles, the truth of the Lord Jesus Christ in the latter day, and we all hold precious and dear." What'd you think when you read that part of the letter?
Oh, I just felt completely alienated, really. True science? I mean, true facts? What about facts? Does a fact become untrue because it doesn't fit with the church? Mm-hmm. This idea that all of these scientific facts that are uncomfortable, they're just going to be disproven eventually. It just doesn't sit with me at all. That's not the way that I approach science. I don't approach it. When we see a prime example of this now with Rodney Meldrum in the Heartland crowd who are defending the Book of Mormon, you know, believe it's based in North America. They're digging into all areas of science and just pulling out things that fit with their theory and throwing away or ignoring anything that doesn't. I just can't function that way at all. But the overall impression of the letter was really, it's really quite threatening. Mm-hmm. It's our way or you can clear off. It was just really completely unhelpful.
Yeah.
But the most disappointing thing was that he had not spoken to me at all. To write that letter, hadn't even spoken to the state president or anyone else that really knew what was going on. There were things that bothered me about the church. It wasn't like, for me, church was an absolutely, a wonderful, fun experience all the time. There were things that bothered me. It's this blind expectation of being blindly obedient to things.
It
was the pressure to do home teaching every month. Sometimes nine families had to be visited a month. You can't do that. Yeah. It doesn't work. Plus, it's invasive. That sort of thing frustrated me. Turning up to priesthood meetings and other sort of meetings down at the stake offices or whatever all the time. I'd go to these meetings and they take a lot of family time, these meetings. They're travelling, like in Australia, it's not uncommon to be driving for half an hour to get to a stake meeting. So if you've got a stake meeting that goes for an hour, that's a 3 to 3.5 hour commitment for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I didn't particularly enjoy those. Most of the time. So to be telling me in this letter that I'm throwing away this wonderful, blissful experience of Mormonism because I'm getting the science wrong. Yeah. But anyway, I wrote back to him, and it was a polite letter, and he kindly wrote back and apologized for sending that letter.
Mm-hmm.
But still, there was still an exhortation in the second letter to come back there are world-renowned scientists at BYU that know all the facts, and they're still faithful in the church.
Yeah, he says in that letter, that follow-up letter, he says, "We have brilliant men at the headquarters of the church, spiritual and knowledgeable intellectuals such as Dr. Hugh Nibley, who may be as near a lay prophet as we have in the church." And he says, "As for my own testimony, if every single scientist on the earth could prove absolutely through DNA or any other means what has been stated in such publications to which you have referred and discussed with Scott Woodward, it would not affect my testimony 1/1000th because of my testimony of the Book of Mormon is in the book itself and not from whence it came."
Mm. Yeah, well, if you read the Book of Mormon, and I've read it a few times, it's a historical document. It's based in reality. It makes historical claims. There's no doubt about it. He's just a very different sort of person to me, and that's all fine if he wants to bury his head in the sand, take that sort of approach to things. He can, but all of the scientists at Brigham Young University have wrestled. It's been a tough wrestle for a lot of those guys. They're all guys, basically. They don't bury their head in the sand like he does. They're trying to fit it. They're trying to fit the Book of Mormon with the facts. And some of them have been more successful than others. By that time I had read some of the stuff, the writings of Hugh Nibley. I don't know what people see in the writings of Hugh Nibley, honestly. I think he attacks the character of the person. I think his arguments are fairly poor. So reading that Hugh Nibley was a lay prophet didn't wash well with me. And by that time I was fairly familiar with limited geography theory, and that didn't satisfy me at all.
I was going to ask you about that, if you've read the church article they put out on the church's website under Gospel Topics, the one called Book of Mormon and DNA Studies, and their discussion about, you know, the limited geography model and what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah, it doesn't really solve the problem. I've written a response on my blog to that letter on the DNA. The limited geography just shifts the problem to a smaller area in the Americas, and that's basically Mesoamerica. Some of the most detailed DNA studies have been done in that area, and it's even more clear that there's just no Hebrew influence in that area. There were massive civilizations in Mesoamerica, and that's why the limited geography has been focused there, because the Book of Mormon really demands that there be literate and large civilizations. If they've done some pretty detailed DNA studies, thousands of mitochondrial DNA tests have been done, virtually all of them have Asian DNA lineages. They've also done some deep sequencing of the entire genome, or deep genotyping of the entire genome of around about 20 Mayans. When you sequence those entire genome, you can or genotype hundreds of thousands of SNP markers. You can pick up European DNA that came in, even very small amounts of European DNA that came into that person's family tree at some stage in their past, and they're just finding nothing.
Yeah,
it's just completely consistent with an Asian origin for all of these people. So then, how do you explain Lehi and his band arriving in the Americas? How do you fit that with them very quickly leading and dominating the two major civilizations, the Lamanite and Nephite civilizations? How does that work? Did they meet these? They never mentioned these Native Americans that they met. How do they take over those civilizations? Without it being apparent in the Book of Mormon, why didn't they just sort of say at some stage in the Book of Mormon that we came across these people that didn't come from Jerusalem? Everyone they came across was linked back to a voyaging group that came out from the Middle East. There's just nothing in the Book of Mormon to indicate that they encountered these people and that they quickly then took the leadership of their civilizations, and they were you know, and within, you know, a few hundred years, they're having wars and battles with armies that are labeled Lamanites and Nephites. So why would the Native Americans who lived there for hundreds of, or for, you know, 10,000 years and built these civilizations, why would they go to war over familial family difficulties that arose from a little band of people that joined them? This sort of deep hatred that lasted for 1,000 years, it just doesn't fit. So yeah, the limited geography does, for me, it just does. It doesn't offer me anything really. I mean, if you desperately have to believe that the Book of Mormon is true in order to keep your whole life together and to make the church work for you, then that's fine. But I think a lot of people really struggle with it. You know, these silly it just causes silly problems. Like, how do you? The gold plates had to be moved. There had to be two Cumorahs, and the gold plates had to be moved to New York from South America or from Central America. And a narrow neck of land is, 160 odd kilometers wide, and just a whole lot of other little problems that I'm not really interested in sort of wrestling with.
Yeah. You know, that article on the gospel topics, they talk about genetic drift. They cite a 2008 paper in the American Journal of Physical Anthropology talking about genetic drift, and they summarize it and say that genetic profiles may be entirely lost and combinations that once existed may become so diluted that they are difficult to detect. They say, in other words, Native Americans whose ancestors include Book of Mormon peoples may not be able to confirm that relationship using their DNA. What are your thoughts on that sort of explanation by the church?
Well, it gets back to this problem. If you're arguing that these people are a tiny, tiny group and they were really unlucky and their DNA disappeared, how does that fit with the Book of Mormon text? Just in my mind, it doesn't fit with the text. I'm sure, John Sorensen's gone through there and he's come up with really odd interpretations of all these different things that he believes conclusively proves that there are other people there. Mm-hmm. We know that there are other people there. We just don't know whether there were Lehites there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just doesn't wash with me.
Yeah. Another thing that comes up a lot, and I know you've written about it in your blog as well, is the Great Surprise article that the National Geographic cites. And it seems like this article gets pushed onto a Mormon or an ex-Mormon or a post-Mormon or a newer Mormon Facebook forum or website about once a week. Someone's bringing it up and saying, this is interesting, or this is maybe this casts doubt on what people are saying about the lack of evidence for the Book of Mormon. And why do you think that – I know you've written about it, but I'm wondering what you think about why people keep posting this article, because it seems like whenever it's posted, there's an immediate response that, you need to look at the dates here, because these dates are – we're talking about people that were – these samples were 18,000 years, 24,000 years ago. I'm curious what you think about why this article keeps coming up all the time.
Well, I think it came up. It's largely because of the headline. The headline that we see is not the headline of the research paper. It's the headline of the I think it was National Geographic. It might have been National Geographic that was quoting from the paper. And right. So to sensationalize it, to make it more interesting, mm-hmm. they say, a third of Native American genes come from Europe. We already know that virtually all of the DNA of Native Americans come from Asia. So, gee, that's really bizarre, isn't it? All of a sudden, a third of their DNA comes from Europe and only two-thirds comes from Asia. The challenge is that they're talking about a different type of DNA. It's nuclear DNA, I mean, if you were to compare our DNA with Africans, like a Native American's DNA with Africans, there are plenty of DNA markers that are common between Native Americans and Africans. Mm-hmm. And their DNA markers are common between many, many populations around the world. So it's no great surprise that a 25,000-year-old Siberian, and that was the person that was in the study, it's no great surprise that they had 30% of their genes appear to be European because they're living in Eurasia. Mm-hmm. So their ancestors had only fairly recently moved from the Middle East. So humans entered Eurasia about 40 to 50,000 years ago. Well, 50,000 years ago, the Australian Aboriginal migration left. But then the migrations into Europe were about 30 to 40,000 years ago. So it was only 10 or 15,000 years ago that that person's ancestors were living in the Middle East. And so the people from the Middle East then moved into Europe and they moved into Asia. So it's no surprise at all that person had markers that are common in Europeans. But the studies, the markers that they were looking at in that study were markers that were in existence 25,000 years ago. The markers that distinguish Native Americans are markers that arose in the last 25,000 years since that person has lived, and particularly in the last 15,000 years since Native Americans migrated into the Americas. So as they move into the Americas, they start to accumulate DNA polymorphisms or SNP markers, whatever you like to call them. They accumulate them, and they're the ones that are specific to Native Americans. And that's so when we're looking at the that study really is only mostly about polymorphisms or DNA markers that were in existence 25,000 years ago. The ones that occur in Native Americans tell us a lot more about how distinct they are and where their ancestors came from. And it's very clear from the evidence that most closely related individuals are a small group of people from Siberia. So yeah, it's a headline. It's a one line grab that members of the church have latched on to. It sounds scientific and whatnot, but it's confusing. It doesn't provide any evidence. You know, Native Americans came from the Middle East. There is no evidence of that.
That's fascinating. I enjoyed reading your blog post about that. I've had some interactions with people about that as well, and so that's great. I'm curious about when you left the church, and when you decided it wasn't true and you weren't going back. Did you have any sort of a crisis about, you know, an existential crisis in a sense about afterlife, or did you maintain some spirituality and belief in God and that sort of thing, or what was that like for you?
Initially I went through basically a roller coaster ride of emotions for a few weeks. So I was, you know, absolutely thrilled because to a large extent, a lot of things were resolved in my mind. I didn't have to bother about the flood and the creation account and many of the other problems, and there were many, many other problems that all get resolved when you reach that one conclusion. So there were moments of, you know, euphoria. I think I was really pleased. But then, so, you know, I was experiencing tremendous highs but also tremendous lows. So when you've lost that belief in the church, it does undermine many other very comforting beliefs you have about eternal families and all that sort of thing. And so I was very upset, but gradually that subsided. I think I then sort of went through a period of a few years where I was sort of, well, probably a few months there where I was thinking, oh, you know, maybe we'll join another church and just become regular Christians. My brother, who left the church at about the same time, he did that for a while. He joined the Anglican church, went back to the Anglicans. We possibly could have done that if we'd found one that we wanted to go to, but we moved home fairly soon at about the time we moved back to Canberra. And so we didn't really feel a great need to join another church. And eventually I think I sort of gradually became a agnostic, fairly hopeful agnostic for a while there. And it's not like I really felt like I really had to resolve this whole thing. But I'd be fair to say that over the years, you know, we're very, very comfortable and happy with the way that we live now. We don't have any particular faith. I know Americans don't like to hear the label atheist. I'm not a strident atheist like some are. I just don't have any belief mm-hmm. in a God or a hereafter. So we should try to make our lives as positive and make the most of the time we have. Mm. So obviously there are times when you it's a little difficult because you've had such strong beliefs, but yeah, we've adjusted to that pretty well now, I think. So all of our family is out of the church now.
Mm. I was going to ask you about how it affected your family, your spouse, mm. your children, that sort of thing.
Well, our oldest daughter, I think she was about 13 or 14 when we left. She was pretty happy not to go to church anymore. And from all of our children were pretty happy and comfortable not to go to church anymore. They weren't bothered. I think all of them pretty much have the same sort of views on life as we do, and all happy and adjusted kids,
great.
You know, getting on with their lives. And yeah. I think it's certainly been a struggle. I think personally I've found it pretty hard to manage relationships with my family, next to my sisters and mother. It's obviously put a tension there, and they've all got very strong faith, and they're not interested in the scientific aspect. So many Mormons are like that, and so I think that's it just creates a tension. Well, it's certainly something that I feel, but I think that's we're dealing with that a lot better now.
Yeah.
And I think that's where, you know, I really admire, you know, guys like John DeLynn. He's copped a lot of criticism from some quarters, but his heart is in the right place. So I really like the work that John's done to, you know, make the church aware that you know, it causes a lot of pain in people's lives when, you know, people don't acknowledge that there really are genuine problems. Mm-hmm. They just bury their head in the sand. You know, it's not just that simple. People are leaving or struggling in the church for very valid reasons. They're sincere, they're honest, they're good people, they're not just suddenly becoming evil and want to do the bad thing, do the wrong things, and so they're looking for an excuse to leave the church. They're people who are sincere and they're still the same loving people, and I think, you know, John's really helped to improve, I guess, the communication that goes on on that front, and you know. I think most people in this issue are in the church and out of the church are good people, and it's just sad that we have this problem.
So we're recording this podcast the day after it was announced that John DeLynn would undergo a court of love, a hearing about whether he should be disfellowshipped or excommunicated or what his status in the church will be. And I'm wondering if you've had much reaction to that decision and if what your thoughts on about if this is a good move for the church or not.
So has he been excommunicated?
No, they just announced that he'll be having a church court towards the end of the month.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any the only outcome really, I think, in this situation can be excommunication. I don't know. It's a very draconian step. It doesn't, 20 or 30 years ago, if you excommunicated somebody, it was a big deal. It shattered their lives. And it was a really terrible experience. But I don't think excommunication really makes all that much difference these days. it seems to me just this pathetic sort of weapon that the church, we're going to excommunicate you, and they strike out, and I think they will. They'll probably excommunicate him. I can't see how it can be avoided.
Yeah.
He doesn't play by the rules. The rules are the church can set the rules. If they want people to sit there and shut up and not express their doubts and to doubt their doubts, if they want people to just do all that and not make things uncomfortable for the leaders, then, he doesn't fit. So they will excommunicate him. It was a foregone conclusion when I got excommunicated. I knew that was going to be the outcome of the court they held for me.
Yeah, when I was interviewing John, your friend John Harwood there, a podcast a few back, he said he really admires you because you left in the late 1990s, you left the church back before it was cool.
I don't know. It was an interesting experience. I knew I was going to be. It was really quite a bizarre experience. Really, I'm not ashamed to talk about anything that took place. Leaving the church was a really difficult experience for our family, and I know. Jane and I became really quite distant from each other. We weren't getting along all that well, and so we just sort of separated for a while. We didn't make any moves to get divorced or anything, but we were separated, and in the real world things happen when people are separated, living separate lives, and the church got wind of something, and so they, rather than charge me with apostasy, which I had been involved in for the last public, open, international apostasy for the previous 3 or 4 years, they decided to charge me with having an inappropriate relationship while I was separated from my wife. And this got into the press in Australia, and it was absolutely bizarre. Australians look at that and think, what the hell is this church doing? This guy's been inactive for all these years. Why delve into his? And he's been publicly questioning the church. Why take him to task on an inappropriate relationship with a woman? I was hauled in. They told me they weren't going to discuss my apostasy. They were only interested in this inappropriate relationship. And so, what's the more serious sin here, guys? Is it public apostasy or inappropriate relationships with somebody who's been inactive for 7 years? And ironically, by the time the church council was held, the court of love, I had reconciled and I was back with Jane, and we've been back together since. So what were they trying to achieve? It was really, really bizarre experience. So, I knew that behind this whole thing was my apostasy. And
Did you publish your book in that time frame, or when did the book come out?
I think the book was published the year before.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that before was the probably. Was held.
Yeah. I think the court was held in 2005. The book was published in 2004.
Okay.
Yeah, so the state prison was well aware of all of these issues. He knew that he'd read my Recovery from Mormonism post. He wouldn't have read my book, but he was well aware of the things that I was struggling with. And we had a few discussions about that. But that was not to be mentioned in the church. He would say he told me he would close the court down. So, which was bizarre, because there were quite a few questions from the High Council during the church court that really necessitated me mentioning, in order to defend my integrity, to mention some of the issues that I was struggling with. That wasn't appropriate. So, yeah, it was a really bizarre experience.
Wow.
So I think I don't really think it's going to make a heck of a lot of difference to John in terms of his outreach to people that are struggling.
Mm-hmm.
It just makes the church look almost powerless to deal with him.
Yeah,
they can only use the only weapon they have, and that is to a formal excommunication, which is, I think it makes the church look very weak. Why can't they? There's absolutely no doubt that John has had a significant positive influence on how the church is dealing with these issues. I'm sure that the essays were influenced by John in terms of their scope and the timing of them and the reason for putting them out there. It's an acknowledgement that many of these problems are genuine, and that's really some of the first things that John did was to really drive home the message to members of the church that these problems are genuine. These are good people who are worried and concerned about real problems.
Mm-hmm.
They're not, and you can't ignore them. And that's why the essays have come about. And I think, the way that Farms has been dismantled, I think that's probably been influenced by John. The way that Daniel Peterson and Midgley and Co. and all, guys like those have dealt with people who are questioning over the internet at times has been just appalling. That's why Farms has been shut down. They're just not good. The church recognises that they just can't have that sort of black and white apologetic going on, which is just so counterproductive.
Yeah, when I left the church, one of the reasons that I decided I didn't believe anymore and wasn't interested in coming back was I'd adopted an African American girl, and it really brought to life to me the issues with racism in the church, and I couldn't get a good explanation from my stake president or my bishop. They try. They're good men. They tried really hard, but they just would try to explain in different ways. But they would refer me to FAIR and the Farms website and things, and send me articles like that. But I just could never get find a good reason for why God would create someone a certain way and then punish them for it.
And then we're told in one of the essays that the church really didn't believe all that stuff anyway.
Which calls into question the idea of being a prophet and talking to God. So either way you explain it, it doesn't make a lot of sense. At least it didn't to me.
The problem I had with Farms and FAIR is that every explanation is painful for all of the problems. And, you know, why do you have to go, why do you have to stretch the bounds of credibility on all of the, every one of these rich problems when you can resolve the whole thing by reaching the conclusion that it's not true? And that just resolves all of those problems in one hit.
Yeah.
You know, the Book of Mormon is entirely consistent with it being created in the mind of, you know, 19th century American at the frontiers. It's entirely consistent with the whole story is entirely consistent with the prevailing wisdom. People that are migrating into, you know, Indian lands in the Ohio Valley and Mississippi Valley.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it fits, yeah, that's the best explanation. And that resolves all these other problems. You don't have to worry about tapirs and you name it.
Yeah. Well, Simon, you know, how are you doing?
Dozens of pathetic explanations. Just gets you nowhere.
Yeah. Well, Simon, bring us up to today and how you're doing and what you're busy with these days.
Well, I've had a recently fairly significant change in my career, which is it sort of explains why I've been reasonably quiet in the blogosphere recently. The work that I've been involved in at CSIRO, I'm a forestry scientist, and we've been working for about a decade to identify DNA markers that can be used by tree breeders to leaves for producing pulp or for producing bioenergy. And that research has been particularly successful over the last 3 or 4 years. So effectively what this means is that using a DNA test, a tree breeder can identify an outstanding tree when it's a seedling. So you can then accelerate your breeding. So that really good tree that's a seedling can go into your breeding program, and you can be crossing that one very, very quickly without having to grow the tree for 7 or 10 years to find out what the tree's like.
Hmm.
So DNA markers are used for early selection. And so about the middle of last year, we pretty much completed a lot of the research. We're sort of ready to spin off from CSIRO, but rather fortuitously, CSIRO had a big funding cut in the middle of last year, and they made most of my team redundant. And so I wasn't actually made redundant, but I volunteered to be made redundant. And my team has now moved into a spin-off company, and we're commercializing the technology that we've developed. So we think it will have a major impact on particularly eucalypt forestry, which is very important around the world. A lot of the high-quality paper that is produced around the world comes from eucalyptus plantations. There's lots of them in South America and Southeast Asia and South Africa.
Yeah.
And so I've moved from a science role into a sort of managing director role in this company.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think it's a big change, but exciting, daunting, but it's keeping me fairly occupied. So I'll be at fairly low profile, I think, for a few years until that's up and running and stable.
Well, that sounds really exciting, Simon. And it's fantastic.
Our family's all doing fine. My wife Jane's a teacher. She loves teaching. She has had a wonderful career in teaching, and so she's carrying on with that. And our children are growing up, moving out of the nest. Quite a few are studying at the moment. So we're in a really good place at the moment. A very happy family. So some of the things that were foretold by Elder Featherstone simply haven't come to pass. But you never know. I'm not dead yet.
Well, your thoughts on how the church is treating John DeLynn? I know in KSL, which is a local radio station and television station in Utah, had reported on the John DeLynn story yesterday and had not mentioned that he was a gay rights advocate or a gay marriage advocate and a women's ordination supporter. But a lot of the other news sites, like some of the news sites in England and other places, had that was the prominent headline, is that, you know, a supporter of equal rights for LGBTQ individuals and women ordination is undergoing excommunication. What were your thoughts on what John DeLynn has done around the rights for LGBTQ individuals?
Well, I think John's done an enormous amount of work, and I think that's a major driver for what John has been doing over the last few years. It's interesting because I never seriously questioned the church, until I encountered the DNA. But I think it might have been when I was about 25, I read the book by Carolyn Pearson, Goodbye, I Love You, in which she described her marriage to a man who turned out to be gay and his real struggles. They were really good friends. They loved each other. But then he couldn't change the way he felt, and eventually they separated, and he was one of the first to die of AIDS. And that was at that point I realized that, gay people are feeling those very strong feelings, the same strength of feeling for people in the same sex that, heterosexuals feel. And they can't really, it's very difficult to change that orientation. We now know that it's virtually impossible. And so, these efforts to reorient people and to insist that they can change, and it just causes enormous damage, because we know the evidence is very clear that it's very difficult to change that orientation, whether it's partly genetic, it's probably partly genetic, partly biological, whatever it is, it seems to happen very early on in a person's life, and it's hardwired and very, very difficult to change, if not impossible. So the church needs to face that, and that's, John is just as much more well aware of these issues than me. And that's why he fights so strongly on that front, because he sees the damage that this false hope of reorientation is causing in the lives of many, many people. And he's seen the suicides, and he's seen the psychological harm that's caused by that. So I think he's done tremendous work on that front.
Yeah.
And it's a major battleground that, the church is just going to have to confront the truth on this one. They still, these apostles still stand up, particularly Boyd K. Packer, and they spout ignorance from general conference. They don't have a clue what they're talking about, because they don't accept the facts and the truth that we know. And until they do, they're always going to deal with this issue the wrong way. The fact of the matter is that, sexual orientation is a very, it's a very complex thing. We know that there are genes that influence it. We know that there are biological things that influence it, the environment in the womb, early childhood, whatever. But if these things are hardwired really early on, it's really, really difficult to change them, and that's well known now that it's a very difficult thing to change. The vast majority, overwhelming majority of attempts to reorient fail, and in the process they cause extreme harm and damage to many people's lives. So, I think John's had a really positive influence on that debate, and hopefully things will move. I think they will move. It's going to be inevitable as society now becomes, very accustomed to gay marriage. I think, within a few few years we'll look back and think, well, how on earth did we ever, deal with the issue that way? I think, the church will continue to look to look more and more bizarre. But they're trying to make the right steps. They have made progress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but yeah, there's still a long way to go.
Yeah, and I think this is just part of that ongoing dialogue that's happening right now that John's a part of and others are part of, in a sense, a war on religion. This last week, the Pope had said something about, he made a statement that you should not mock religion. He's referring to the attacks in Paris. And it's just part of that dialogue the world is having right now about, is religion something that should be, you should not criticize religion? Is it not, valid to do so, or what? So I think, and John's been a big part of that for the Mormon church. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out and to see if he is excommunicated, what that will mean for those who are struggling with their faith and struggling to remain a part of it or figure out these difficult issues.
Yeah. No, I think the church does need to eventually get to the point where you can tolerate, there can be questioning and there can be debate and there can be discussion, because it's only progress in the world only comes by debate, argument, looking at the evidence, weighing up the facts, more arguing. Open, healthy argument is required, really.
Yeah.
And that, it does mean expressing your doubts and talking about them in public forums in the church. I went to an Anglican church once where somebody in the congregation had a real argument with the minister, and they didn't come to the church next week, but they came the week after. The minister was used to that sort of thing. They argued stuff. They didn't do it all behind closed doors. Like, if you questioned anything in the church of any significance, could you please come into my office? Come into the bishop's office and we can talk about this where there's no one else listening.
Right.
That's not allowing debate or critical thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
But yeah, in terms of the broader problems, yeah, it's really sad to see what's going on in France. And I'm just a bit surprised that the Pope would say that religion shouldn't be criticised, because I think he's been doing an awful lot of criticising of his own over the last few years. I think the Catholics have made tremendous progress over the last few years. I think he's been, from what I've seen, a pretty positive influence on the church. I don't know. I think a lot of other churches are pretty comfortable with people criticising and debating and thinking about stuff.
As J. Ruby Clark said, if we have the truth, what's the quote?
The truth should withstand scrutiny.
Yeah, basically is what he's saying, yeah.
Yeah.
So,
but, I think we need to, it'd be good to get to a point where, families aren't broken up or divided when somebody chooses not to believe any longer in Lots of Anglicans go to the Anglican Church but don't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a funny organisation, but I think it's their family, it's their friends. That's what John's really fighting for here. He wants to, he wants to be in that community that he's, he loves many of the members of the church. He wants to be in that community.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, I'm not sure that they're ready for him. Yeah. Hopefully we'll get to the point where people like John can be comfortably situated in the church.
Yeah.
But, a few more years to go, I reckon.
I guess so. Yeah,
but look back on what's happened over the last, since I left the church, it's dramatic changes have occurred.
Yeah.
Who would have thought we'd have essays like have got on them.
Oh, I think if you had taken some of those essays back in time in a time machine, if you could do that, and you'd read them in church or read them to a bishop or somebody, you would probably be disciplined for it. It would be considered anti.
Oh yeah, if it didn't have church
material, yeah.
If you took the PR department or the church's imprint off them and just read them as essays produced by somebody, you would be hauled into a disciplinary council quick smart. It's probably only 5 years ago, or 3 years ago.
Yeah, the admission that the Abraham papyrus, the scrolls don't mention Abraham or you know, they're not the book of Abraham itself would have been blasphemy back, you know, even 15, 20 years ago.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, even less than that. So.
Oh, yeah, probably even a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
So big steps, but I think they're largely hidden from, at the moment, the essay is largely hidden from most of the members, I think.
Yeah.
But, you know, most members, you know, I think the majority of Mormons are not really going to be all that bothered because they're not really, we're probably a little bit different, I guess, than most members. If you intellectualize about things. I used to be like that. I didn't intellectualize about my beliefs. It was only, you know, by the time I was 38 that I really started to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a dilemma. It's a how do you handle that crowd of questioning folk who have genuine problems? How do you fit them comfortably in an organization where the vast majority are not interested, or don't they think very differently about the church, or they don't really think, they really feel it. It's the spiritual feeling experience that they're there for, right, and not the intellectual part. So I don't know how you fit them all together in the one box. That's not my problem, though. That's what the prophet's got to sort out.
I was told by many people.
I suspect we'll probably sort it out.
Yeah. I remember being told by many people, you're thinking too much about it. Don't think so much about these issues and questions and things. And so the fact that they would say that always kind of bothered me.
Mm.
Well, you sound like you're pretty outside, pretty happy with your life and your family and what's going on outside of the church.
Well, I think it's if you compare the situations, say that, you know, John DeLynn is in and I'm in, you know, he's immersed in a culture and a society that's heavily Mormon. So the church influences so many things. You just see the church all around you.
Mm-hmm.
In Canberra, I don't see it at all. It's effectively invisible.
Yeah.
I think there are three chapels in, no, two, two chapels in Canberra.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the only interaction I have is slightly through family. But we don't talk about the church. So it's not I can go for days and days without thinking about it. Fit very comfortably into the Australian society, which is reasonably secular.
Yeah. Well, we've had you think about it a lot here and appreciate it, and I'll let you get back to your not thinking about it for a while. And really appreciate your time and willingness to talk to Mormon Expression Voices. Is there anything that we missed that you wanted to touch on, or do you think we covered it all?
No, I think
we're good.
Yep.
Okay. Yep. Well, good. Thank you again for your time.
You're welcome. All right. Good to talk, Jason. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jason.
Coincidence of living trap hung in place. Crazy when I thought I knew the meaning of it all. Crazy when I sought to please and make.